So the plan is for tonight is first to discuss the solution to assignment 2. It's really all there in the handout, but might walk through it, see if there are any questions. I got a few via email during the week. And then I'm going to open it up to questions about the project. And then we'll get into the lecture material, which will be hopefully most of the evening. And let me remind you, there's a lecture on Monday. In addition to Thursday next week, there's a lecture on Monday, which is the is in the syllabus, I believe, so it should not be a surprise to anybody. So the assignment two is basically to get comfortable with reading and analyzing execution histories to determine whether they're serializable, recoverable, avoid cascading aborts, and are strict. So the solution actually has the assignment embedded in it, which is to make it easy to go over. But basically, the way to go about this is just to do what I did in class. You just systematically start from the beginning of the execution, from the first read or write, and for each one, you ask the question of whether it conflicts with anything that preceded it. And of course, for the first element, the answer is no, nothing. And then you just keep marching left to right, and each time you hit an element, you look at all the previous ones and see whether there's a conflict. And in the first one, the conflicts are listed for 1A. For example, R2 of YZ precedes and conflicts with W3 of YZ. Actually, you don't need both of them, but it just so happens that they both are covered there. So, also, R3 of XY precedes and conflicts with W1 of X, and W2 of Z, right to right of Z by transaction 2, precedes and conflicts with R3 of Z. So that means, in terms of serialization graphs, we have that transaction 2 has to precede transaction 3, transaction 3 has to precede transaction 1, and then again, transaction 2 has to precede transaction 3. So those are all turned into edges in the serialization graph. And so you have 0 before everything in all these cases, and then 2 before 3 before 1. So it is serializable, but only in that one order. And if you look at all of the... So to check for recoverability and related concepts, you're really looking at all the read operations. And for each read, you want to... Well, first, for all the read operations, you want to check that each read is reading from a write that had already committed. And if it did, then it avoids cascading abort. If it didn't, if it read from a write that did not commit in between the write operation and the subsequent read, then you have to look to see what the order of the commit operations are to check that the write operation committed before the read transaction committed, which could be later, which will be later in the history. In that case, it's recoverable. And then strictness is, in addition, you never have a transaction which overwrites uncommitted data. So there you have to look at all the write operations and check that the previous write operation on the same piece of data has a commit operation in between, that the operation that was overwritten committed before the second write that overwrote it. So execution number 2 is the same as 1, except that X is omitted from the first read and the commit is moved later. And because we've omitted X from R3, then we no longer have R3 preceding and conflicting with W1 of X. So one of the constraints in the history goes away. So now we have 2 before 3, but we no longer have 3 before 1. So 3 could be before 1, 3 can be after 1, doesn't matter. And so you have more possible executions. And because the commit was moved after, the commit of transaction 2 was moved after the read of read 3 of Z, that means that read 3 of Z is now reading uncommitted data. So you have R3 of Z following W2 of Z. It's reading uncommitted data, and therefore it allows cascading aborts. However, it's still the case that transaction 2 commits before transaction 3, so you are recoverable. Okay. And then for execution 3, history 3, you've got a cycle in the serialization graph. That transaction, you have R2 precedes and conflicts with W3, and then you have an R3 that precedes and conflicts with W2. So 2 comes before 3, 3 comes before 2. There's no equivalent serial execution. There's a cycle in the serialization graph. And the execution is strict. It's recoverable, avoids cascading aborts, and it's strict. One thing I noted here is that you see there's R2 of YZ precedes and conflicts with W3 of Y in history 3, and that never has any effect on recoverability. So, you know, we worry about reads that come after a conflicting write, we care about writes that come after a conflicting write, but we don't care about writes that come after a conflicting read. That has no effect on these recovery characteristics. It will later on if we dig deeply. I'm not sure I'll delve into it much, but it's, yeah.
It does affect serialization, though.
It does. All conflicts affect serializability. So it does affect serialization. It just doesn't affect the recovery properties. And then the fourth one is weird, because you may have noticed that R3 of Z comes after transaction 3 commits. You may not have noticed. You may have been focusing so hard on conflicts you missed that one. So transaction 3 committed, and then two elements later, transaction 3 is still alive and reading. No, this is an illegal history. Could not have happened. It's just not well formed. If it is possible, you know, through various malfunctions, that after transaction 3 committed, that a read operation from transaction 3 might arrive in the data manager, and the data manager is expected to do something with it, and the right response is, who are you? Right? Basically, transaction 3 is out of the picture. Here he's basically received a message from the grave, you know. Transaction 3 is long gone, but the mail is still arriving. And it just rejected. The transaction is not active. It will not process an operation on behalf of transaction 3. So the operation might have arrived, and we'll come later when we start thinking about how transactions execute and messages flow and why this kind of thing might happen. But so it could have happened, but it could not have executed. So this history just is impossible. The only way this execution could happen is if the data manager malfunctioned, if it doesn't behave according to spec. And then another weirdness in this one is that now we have W3 of YZ precedes R3 of Z. And you might wonder, what is that? Transaction 3 wrote Z, and then transaction 3 read Z? I mean, it wrote Z, it knows what Z is. Why does it have to read Z? Well, it may look weird, but it actually is very, it's very possible, because if you're running high-level operations like SQL statements, you know, where you're sort of reading all employees in the toy department, and then you're reading all employees who earn over $50,000 later in the same transaction, you might end up having written something that you previously, reading something that you previously wrote, because you're identifying groups of things to read based on their values. And some of those values may be things that you updated earlier. You just didn't realize that they were you already had read them into memory, so you're going to read them again. It's perfectly okay. It does happen. That's called a reflexive reads from, in technical serializability terminology, a reflexive reads from. And they actually do cause trouble in some algorithms, some concurrency control and recovery algorithms. You have to be pretty careful about it. But it's not something we're going to be making a whole lot of fuss over. It'll just sort of, its behavior will naturally fall out the kinds of approaches we're dealing with here. Yeah?
So it says the answer is the same as a 3. Could that mean same as a 2, since it's the same as a 2?
Yes, sorry. Okay, that's a typo. It's because... Never mind. Because I didn't proofread it carefully enough. Okay, the second to last line on the solution where it says answers are the same as in 3, I guess that should be as in 2. And then the final one is the same as the first history, except that R3 now is not reading X, and Z is replaced by X and W3, and C2's moved after C3. And since there's a bunch of changes, we just walk through and go through all of the conflicts again. And this time, there is another cycle in the serialization graph. We have 1 before 3, 2 before 3, and then 3 before 1. So we have 1 before 3 and 3 before 1 messes us up. So again, it's not serializable. It's also not recoverable because W2 of Z precedes R3 of Z, but the commits happen in the opposite order, which is the bad case for recoverability. And if you're not recoverable, then you don't avoid cascading aborts, and you're not strict because it's the definitions stack. So you fail on one, you fail on all of them. Okay? Questions? Any more questions? Clear? If you didn't do the assignment, go back and check it. Go through this and look at the solution pretty carefully. Make sure you understand it, because it's very easy to develop exam questions like this. Project. I've been getting a few questions on the project, so I don't know, are there things people want to discuss about the project before we dive into the lecture?
Yeah. Just to confirm a question asked by Matt. You have a hash table, right, that represents the disk, pretty much, right, for step one. And then, so whenever we're going to do the shadowing, you pretty much have to make a copy of that whole hash table. Like, I mean, there are no.
So, you know, the way the sample code is structured, I don't know, can you hear the question on the other end over at UW?
Not really.
No? Okay, I'll repeat questions tonight then. The question was whether, given that the database, or the disk, if you will, is represented by a hash table, then it seems like you have to create a shadow copy of the entire hash table. There's no finer grain structure to really work with, since you're going to basically serialize it and write it out to disk. And the answer is yes, the way it's currently put together. That's true. There's nothing sacrosanct about any of the software we've given you. The idea is to get you started easily and be able to quickly get into the interesting things to think about without having to think about stupid things about how you're going to represent the database and the like. Right? But, you know, it's a simulation, in effect, of a system. And so if you want to shadow at finer grain, you can. You're going to need to change data structures to do that. And it's one of many things you can do. You're not obligated to do that one. I mean, you know, you can do as much as interests you and you want. But I mean, at least you should be shadowing there. Now, that doesn't mean that you are stupid about the number of copies of the table that you make, either in memory or on disk. I mean, there are relatively nice and efficient ways of doing it, and then there are very, what shall I say, sort of using a sledgehammer to solve a problem that doesn't really require such a heavy-handed approach. You can try to be a little more elegant and clever about it. So, you know, we will be looking for that. And I mean, and you want to think about that. I mean, that's part of the project, is to think about those design questions. Yeah.
So later steps in the project show multiple resource manager instances. Is the idea that each resource manager is managing like a type of, you know, like cars or hotels and stuff like that? And but they're all supposed to write to the same file on disk, or they're each writing to their own file?
Okay. So the observation is later steps of the project, you've got multiple resource managers. They're presumably the resource managers are managing different resource types like cars and hotel rooms and flights. At that point, do they all write to the same file? No.
Okay.
I mean, that, you know, imagine they're now distributed. They're running on different. Imagine they're running on different computers on a network, or could be.
Okay.
So the expect now initially they are. I mean, initially they share. I mean, again, it's just a suggestion of sort of how to move through it methodically. But initially, you can put them all into one storage class and one storage manager, and they're written out to one file, and you know, you can do it that way. But eventually, we're going to get to the point where they're in multiple resource managers, multiple files, multiple computers, and hence two-phase commit.
So, kind of a follow-up to that, because there was a comment earlier, sort of an aside here, to write the RM so it uses your new storage class, and in fact write it such that all RM instances use the same storage instance. Is that kind of counter to what you're saying, or I'm trying to figure out what the statement is meaning there?
There's a terminology problem in the project that is maybe leading you astray, so the question is that early step. What is it? I think it's step one, isn't it?
Yes.
Says that, you know, to have one break out the hash table in effect into a storage class and store all resources in the same storage class, and then eventually have multiple resource managers maybe use the same storage class for the different resource types.
Okay.
I forget exactly how it's phrased, but the point is that if you want to avoid two-phase commit, you've got to have one database. As soon as you've got two independent databases that you're committing to independently, you're into two-phase commit, or you're at least acknowledging the fact that atomicity is going to be a problem. All right, so initially it's just get it to work, basically. And since you're headed toward multiple storage classes, I know some people occasionally just skip that step, and they're just really confident, they understand how the design is going, and they just go straight to, you know, multiple RMs, multiple storage classes, multiple files. And then if you do that, you may want to have transactions only manipulate one resource type, at least while you're testing, just because it's going to otherwise be hard to be sure you've got the main path running correctly. But you can organize the work any way you want.
In one of your mails, you said, please include a makefile like the one given in the project code. So is it not okay to give you a solution or something?
I don't know. That's really, why don't you send an email to Abhay? I don't know. Do you have, Abhay, you want to answer that now?
What's the question?
The question is whether a Visual Studio solution file is good enough, or you really want a makefile.
I would prefer a makefile.
You prefer the makefile?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any reason?
I think he's not a Windows person like the rest of you.
But how's he gonna compile
this? I don't know. Why don't you exchange mail? Maybe somebody wants to help him.
He can just use MS Build.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway. He needs to be able to build and run your systems. So, sort of between you and him, I think that. Other questions? Going once, going twice. Okay. So. Okay, so we are on slide 19, chapter 3. It's the next slide after where we ended last time. In effect, by going through the solution, I guess we went through the lecture material or reviewed the concepts there. Are there any lingering questions on the lecture material before I continue here? All right, so you understand the goal now. It's serializability and strictness. And the question is how to get it. What's the mechanism we're going to use to get those properties? And what people generally do is they use locking. And the concept is pretty straightforward, that each transaction sets a lock on each data item that it's going to access before it does the access. And that lock prevents other transactions from operating on that same data in a conflicting way. You know, intuitively this makes sense, and you do this all the time, right? You set a lock, then you read this piece of data, X, and the expectation is that because you have the lock, no other program is going to write into X. And for some reason you think that's a good thing. I don't know if you ever thought deeply about why that was a good thing. If one is reading absolutely simultaneously to the other one writing, that certainly is a bad thing. But if the write happens immediately after the read, is that okay? Well, maybe, I don't know. We'll see. We know that conflicting accesses are a problem in general, and that even if the reads and writes are atomic one by one, if you have enough conflicts, the execution, the history, will not be serializable. So it's not just the fact that one transaction is reading X while simultaneously another transaction is writing X. I mean, that surely would be a mess, because heaven knows what the read would actually read if they were absolutely simultaneous. But even if they're never simultaneous, the fact that they conflict causes trouble for serializability. And for some reason, you've been under the impression all these years that setting locks was a good thing, that somehow that helped out. So let's see why. So each transaction sets a lock before it accesses the data. So there are read locks and write locks. These are sometimes called shared locks and exclusive locks, but they always correspond exactly to the set of operation types. So I'm going to call them read locks and write locks, so it's really clear that they go with the corresponding operations. And if one transaction has a write lock on a piece of data, X, then no other transaction can obtain a read lock or a write lock on X. And conversely. So if a transaction has a read lock on X, then no other transaction can obtain a write lock on X. So the rule is you cannot have two write locks or a read lock and a write lock simultaneously on the same piece of data. You can have multiple read locks at the same time, that's okay. So the possible states of a piece of data are no locks, one or more read locks, or one write lock. Those are the only possibilities. And if a read lock or a write lock request arrives and there's already a conflicting lock, then it has to wait. It can't obtain the lock, at least not until the conflicting lock is released. So let's look at the example here. So transaction I sets a read lock on X. So RL now means read lock. And and then RUI of X means transaction I has unlocked its read lock on X. Right? So the notation's clear. So now let's look at some example histories. Transaction 1 sets a write lock on X and then writes X, which is perfectly okay. And now transaction 2 sets a read lock on X. No, not valid. That's exactly the kind of thing that is not allowed to happen. There had to be an unlock in between. So transaction 1 sets a write lock, transaction 1 writes X. Now transaction 1 unlocks X. Now it's okay for transaction 2 to set a read lock on X because the write lock has been released. So if you see a sequence like this where you've got a write lock and a read lock, for example, two conflicting locks, and there's no unlock in between, that means that there's a mistake. You're not obeying the locking rules. So locking rules are clear. They seem very intuitive. Seems like they would work. But they don't. If you downloaded these slides last week, then this slide is probably messed up in your copy. But there is a new copy online which has this slide correctly done. I should have sent out email to warn you. I apologize for that. But it's just the one slide. So what we have here is... is two transactions. They're in two rows. The first row is transaction 1. Transaction 1 starts out by read-locking X, reading X, and then unlocking X. All right, so that seems okay. It's done with X. It's not going to access X anymore. And then later on, it's going to write-lock Y, write Y, and then unlock Y. So it's always setting a lock on the data before it accesses it, and then at the end it commits. Now, these arrows are just because I can't lay this out horizontally on one line. But after transaction 1 has unlocked X, at this point, transaction 2 starts executing. And what it does is it obeys locking. It read-locks Y, it reads Y, it write-locks X, it writes X. I mean, it could lock anything at this point because there are no locks in the system. Transaction 1 has released its one and only lock. And then it releases its locks and commits. So it reads. So basically, if you avoid or if you ignore the lock operations here, what's going on is pretty simple. It's just reading Y and writing X. And then everything else is just the locking. And similarly, transaction 1 is reading X and writing Y. And all of the rest is locking. And so the actual history, ignoring lock operations, is you've got the transaction 1 is reading X. That's the first one. And then transaction 2 is reading X and reading Y and writing X. And then it commits over here. And then transaction 1 writes Y and commits. All right, so this line here is exactly the same as the one appeared above, except it doesn't have any of the lock operations. And a simple analysis says that it's not serializable because transaction 1 read X and subsequently wrote X. So that says we have 1 precedes 2. And then we also have transaction 2 reads Y and then transaction 1 writes Y. So we have 2 precedes 1. So that's not serializable. So apparently, locking doesn't work. Or at least it's not enough. What's needed is that there's a rule on when you can release locks. And the rule is that once a transaction has released a lock, it cannot obtain any more locks. Or stated in the contrapositive, it has to obtain all of its locks before it releases any of them. That's called two-phase locking. So it's the basic locking rules that I started out with. Transaction reads X, sets a read lock on X. To write X, it sets a write lock on X. And it holds each lock until after it executes the corresponding operation, and moreover, after its first unlock operation, it requests no more locks. That's the two phase. Phase one is its acquiring locks. Phase two is its releasing locks. Every transaction has to obey, if it's going to use locking, it has to obey this this rule. And if we back up, the problem that we had is transaction one. It released its lock on X, and then it later obtained a lock on Y. That's exactly what it's not allowed to do, even though they're on different pieces of data, which is, I think, the counterintuitive part. That it's unlocking X and then locking Y, and that's no good. And the reason is easy to see from this example, is that if a transaction unlocks one piece of data and then it locks another piece of data, it's creating a window. And in that window, another transaction can jump in, and it can have a conflicting operation on the data that was unlocked, as well as a conflicting operation on the data that will subsequently be locked. And therefore, it will seem like it's coming after the operation that already ran and before the operation that has yet to come. And therefore, it will not be serializable. It'll look like it came later and earlier at the same time. So that's the intuitive origin of the two-phase rule. But intuition only takes you so far in this game. There is a theorem that says that if all transactions in an execution are two-phase locked, then the execution is serializable. And I do hardly any of this proving of anything in this course, but I think this proof is worth looking at. It's the simplest proof I know for why locking works. And the way it goes is that we're going to define a relationship between transactions, which is this double arrow. And that we'll say that transaction I, I'll use the word precedes transaction K, if either transaction I read X and transaction K later wrote X, or transaction I wrote X and transaction K later read or wrote X. So in other words, transaction I precedes and conflicts with, has an operation that precedes and conflicts with an operation of transaction K. Let me repeat that. That's what the arrow, that double-headed arrow says. Transaction I has an operation that precedes and conflicts with some operation of transaction K. Which, of course, in terms of serialization graphs, means that in any equivalent serial history, transaction I has to come before transaction K. Right. So, if we know that transaction I precedes and conflicts with transaction K, then that must mean that transaction I released a lock before transaction K obtained a conflicting lock. Why is that? Well, transaction I had an operation like WI of X, and later on transaction K had a conflicting operation like RK of X. And the only way that can happen in locking means that transaction I, which had a lock on X when it wrote X, must have released that lock to enable transaction K to obtain that lock. Right? So if we have this relationship that transaction I precedes and conflicts with transaction K, then we know that transaction I released the corresponding lock before transaction K got that lock on whatever the data is that they conflict on. All right, so that's the first step. Now, let's suppose that this is true along a path. So we have transaction I precedes and conflicts with K, and K precedes and conflicts with M. By the way, you can see I'm avoiding certain letters here. J and L are just hard to see. Right? They start looking like other letters, so that's the only reason I did that. So we know from the previous step that transaction I released a lock before transaction K obtained some lock, some conflicting lock. Right? So I released a lock before K obtained some lock. And then we also know that K released a lock before M obtained some lock. Right? Same thing. But K, which is sitting in the middle here, obtained all of its locks before it released any of them. Okay? So what that means is that transaction I, the lock that transaction I released that conflicted with K, that release operation must have preceded in real time transaction M's operation to obtain the corresponding lock, even though they don't conflict. Even though they don't conflict. This is exactly the two slides ago, right? Transaction I released a lock on X, which transaction K obtained, and then transaction K released a lock on Y that transaction M obtained. And we know that transaction K obtained all of its locks before it released any of them. So the lock up, so transaction K's lock operation on X precedes its unlock operation on Y. So that means the unlock operation on X precedes the lock operation on X, which precedes the unlock operation on Y, which precedes the lock operation on Y. All right, all in real time. So that's the next step of the induction. So remember that these precedes and conflicts with is exactly the relationship in serialization graphs. So the only thing that can go wrong to be non-serializable is we have a cycle in the serialization graph, which means we must have a path starting from one transaction and ending in the same transaction following a sequence of these precedes and conflicts with, right? That's how we would end up with a non-SR execution. But according to the previous argument, that means that transaction I released a lock and sometime later transaction I obtained a lock. That's what the previous step said. But that breaks the two-phase rule. So it cannot have happened. Therefore, the cycle cannot exist. Therefore, the execution must be serializable. Now, this may seem like we sort of backed into this proof. I mean, it's not exactly constructive, you know. I mean, I think you would like to see is something constructive that says that, well, because of the way that they obtain locks, we're going to be able to serialize in a certain way, and therefore the result is surely serializable. We didn't do that. What we said is, if we were non-serializable, there would be a cycle in the serialization graph. If there's a cycle in the serialization graph, then one of the transactions must have broken the two-phase rule, which is not nearly as satisfying. Now, it's a solid proof, and it is absolutely the shortest proof I know of by far of why two-phase locking works. And it's no wonder that it's not something that just jumps out at you, that you kind of look at this two-phase thing and say, oh yeah, of course. So one way to look at it, I'm going to try to walk around this next few slides a little bit to give you some intuition for it. In effect, what's happening is for every transaction, there is a point in time where it owns all of the locks on all of the data that it accesses, right? And that's the moment it obtains its last lock, right? At the end of the growing phase, it has all of the locks on all of the data it's going to access, right? Because as soon as it releases one of them, it's not going to be able to get any more, right? So it's as if you were running the transaction at that moment in time. because any transaction with a conflicting lock, its conflict either came earlier, in which case it must have released that lock and in any others that get in the way, and so it must have, its point, we'll call this the locked point, give it a name. The locked point is the point at which the transaction owns all of its locks, the first point in time where it owns all of its locks. Any transaction that had a conflicting lock, either that conflict happened earlier, in which case it released the corresponding lock earlier, which means its locked point came earlier, which means that all of its locks must come earlier, and this is the hand wave, because that's not at all obvious. Or it came later, in which case, if the conflict came later, that means it obtained the lock after this transaction released the corresponding lock. Therefore, its locked point must have come later. So it's locked, so we can totally order the locked points in time. And, in fact, you can serialize transactions according to their locked points. And that, I'm not going to, that's not a simple proof, but it is true. So maybe that counts as better intuition for you. But the proof is not, I wouldn't attempt to do the proof. It's much longer. What about recoverability? Surprisingly, two-phase locking does not guarantee recoverability. And here's a very simple example. Transaction 1 has one operation. It writes X. That's it. That's the whole transaction. Transaction 2 has one operation. It reads X. And transaction 1 releases its write lock right there, right before transaction 2 starts to run. Now, transaction 1 has not yet committed. I mean, it can, but it is two-phase locked because it only has one operation, and it released its lock and is not going to obtain any more locks. It just so happens that it's going to commit much later. Sort of stupid, but it's legal. Doesn't break any rules. And so now we have transaction 2 reading transaction 1's write and committing before transaction 1 commits. And that breaks recoverability. Well, but we can easily, so it, therefore, I mean, it's not strict, it doesn't avoid cascading aborts. So interestingly, two-phase locking by itself enforces none of the recoverability conditions. And this is why I went to the trouble of explaining them separately. If you got them all for free, then it would be kind of an academic exercise. Because you say, well, you know, if you're serializable, you know, first of all, if you're serializable, then you're recoverable. We already know that's not true from the last assignment, that they're quite independent. You could be recoverable and not serializable. You could be serializable and not recoverable. They're just unrelated concepts. They both are influenced by conflicts, but it's not like any of them imply the other. And similarly, locking, which gives you serializability, doesn't automatically give you any of these recovery conditions either. So, but locking can give you those conditions. You just have to hold your locks a little longer. If a transaction holds all of its write locks until after it commits, then the recovery, then the execution is going to be strict. Because if it holds all of its write locks until after it commits, that means that no transaction can either read or overwrite any of the data that it wrote while it was uncommitted. Because in order to write the data, it has to have a write lock on the data. Once it has a write lock on the data, no other transaction can get a read lock or a write lock on the data. And it's going to hold on to its write locks until after it's committed, at which point it's perfectly safe for transactions to read or overwrite the data. So simply by holding on to write locks until after the transaction commits, you're strict. The execution is strict. Now, you know, I hate to be nitpicking about it, but it's not okay to release your write locks immediately before you commit. And in fact, the previous execution demonstrated that. Because you open up a window between the last write and the commit. And although it looks like a pretty big window, and you say, well, but you know, between the unlock here and the commit here, well, I mean, there can't be very much time because after all, I mean, it's just a ready to commit. It's only going to take a couple of milliseconds. Well, you know, we're going to be running a few thousand transactions per second, and it could happen, right? It could happen that some other read operation jumps in at the wrong moment. And, you know, the power can go out any old time. So it could be that the transaction 2, you know, it reads the right operation from transaction 1, it commits, and then right here, that's when the power goes out. Now you say, ah, what are the odds of that happening? Pretty low, you know. I mean, maybe that's only a millisecond window. But that's not the right question. The right question is when the power goes out, what are the chances that the system is in that state for one of the transactions that was running? I mean, you're running several thousand transactions per second. What do you think the odds are? Well, they may be pretty good, you know, if everybody's releasing their write locks between the time they finish their last write and the time they commit, there's going to be a lot of those little windows floating around the system where somebody could be jumping in and reading it at the wrong moment. So that might not work. So it actually does matter. All right, so we're going to hold on. So that's called strict two-phase locking. Hold on to write locks till after the transaction commits. Now, the interesting thing about all this is it can be totally automated. You might, you know, that when you first look at these rules, it's, you know, good grief. You know, all these rules, the application programmer is having enough time writing correct code. On top of this, they've got to lock all these pieces of data at just the right moment and hold on to the locks until just the right time. And everybody's got to do it because, as we saw from the first example, if even a single transaction breaks the two-phase rule, then the execution is not serializable. Right? And, you know, not everybody writing transaction applications has taken this course. So, you know, the odds that this is going to work out, not so good. Fortunately, it can be totally automated. And the way you automate it is that the data manager, me, you know, in this little simulation I've been doing in front here, last couple lectures, every time I receive a read or a write operation from a transaction, before I run the operation, I set the lock. It's not hard. I get a read operation from transaction 1 on X. Fine. First, I set a read lock for transaction 1 on X. Once I get the lock, then I run the read. I can't get the lock because some other transaction has a write lock on X. Okay. Well, I just hold on to that read for a while until the conflicting lock is released. Okay? So remember, I started out this topic by saying there's only three things that I can do when an operation shows up, right? I can run it right away, I can delay it for a while in the hopes that I can run it later, or I'll reject it. I won't run it at all. So here, if I have a conflict, if R1 of X arrives, and I've already got W0 of X holding a lock on X, then I just delay it. I just set it aside, and I'll run it later after transaction 0 commits. And the other thing, now what about the two-phase rule? Well, the two-phase rule is I will not release any of a transaction's locks until after I process the commit for the transaction. So, you know, the commits and aborts are coming in to me also. After all, I'm the data manager. I'm the one who has to write all this stuff to persistent storage to get the durability property. So I've got to be told about the commit. So I'll wait until, you know, the commit's fully processed, and then I will release the write locks. Now, notice that I can actually release the read locks earlier. As soon as I receive the commit from the transaction, I know the transaction is done. It has no more work to do. It would not have given me the option to commit the transaction if it had any other reads or writes to accomplish. Right? So given that I've received the commit, I can actually release the read locks immediately, but I have to hold on to the write locks for the transaction till after I'm done committing. Now again, it's one of those things of, come on, I mean, you know, how long does it really take to run a commit? The answer is not long. I don't know. 5 milliseconds, 10 milliseconds, not long. But, you know, we're running at a high speed, you know, running on gigahertz processors, and it's milliseconds a long time. So if I can release the lock earlier, why not? It'll help unblock some of these other transactions that had write operations that were waiting for these read locks to be released. It won't help any read operations. You know, releasing read locks doesn't help any read operations. The read operations that are blocked are waiting for write locks to be released. We're only releasing read locks, but at least, you know, we can end up helping out some of the blocked transactions. Okay? All right, so that's the locking story. It's very basic, and it actually is the whole locking story. I mean, I could stop right now. Everything else is implementation detail. About 4 or 5 hours of lecture worth. Not all tonight, you'll be glad to know. But getting this, as simple as this sounds, getting this to work well is surprisingly challenging for many reasons. There's a lot of locks, there's a lot of conflicts, the conflicts slow things down, there are deadlocks to worry about, there's all kinds of trouble. And every one of these problems that has been experienced has led people down a path over the years of developing more mechanism to circumvent it, so that locking systems are actually enormously complex, even though this very simple protocol at bottom is really all that's going on. Yeah.
Are there any systems that have a way for a transaction or for a workflow controller or something to say, I'm not going to acquire any more locks so you can release my read locks, but I'm not ready to commit yet because I have some writes due for locks that I already hold.
All right, so the question is it, are there systems that allow a transaction to say that it's done accessing shared data, it has no more reads or writes to do, and therefore it can tell the data manager to release its read locks even though it's not ready to commit, because it is perfectly safe from a, both from a serializability and a recovery standpoint. No, I don't know of any systems that do that, but it sounds like a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Why would you not be ready to commit?
Why would you not be ready to commit?
Yeah, why would you not commit at that time? Why is commit not that?
Well, you're holding write locks, so maybe you're not done writing. Maybe you've got some long computations to do to write. You know, maybe
you're going to do more writes to the database.
You know, you're still holding on to your write lock, so you know, it is a reasonable thing to consider, but I've never heard of anybody who has built it.
Wouldn't what you just mentioned cause a deadlock, though, because you will hold a lock for a given transaction, right? And then another transaction comes that asks for a completely different lock, and you are holding onto that one, but at some point they might ask for each other's lock, right?
Right. So the question is,
do we wait and, like, before actually acquiring the locks to see everything?
Okay, so the question is, how do we deal with waiting situations? Are we worried about deadlocks? What are we going to do about this? Coming soon. Before the night is yet young. I would give you a quick and simple answer if there were one, but the only way I know how to do it is to kind of develop it. Okay. Let's take a break. Take 5 or so. All right, so the only way we're going to synchronize transactions is through locking, which means that if transactions communicate in any way other than accessing shared data, we're not going to synchronize them. So just to take a simple example, if a transaction sends a message which another transaction receives, and that message is sent out of band, you know, it's not, you don't send it by storing it in the database and reading it out of the database, you just send it over the wire, then that could create a transaction ordering which is different than the one that's being developed by the locking system. So what we have here is transaction 1 wrote X, and then transaction 2 read X. So transaction 1 comes before transaction 2. But then transaction 2 is sending a message which is subsequently being read by transaction 1. So the execution is not serializable, but some user sees the output on the display and, based on what the user read, provides some input to another transaction over here. So that's just as good as sending a message. There's no message in this picture, right? All that happened was transaction one displayed something on the screen, and then the user who read it typed something into transaction two. So apparently, even displaying something on a screen before the transaction commits is already a potential source of difficulty, because it's just another form of message passing between transactions.
You need to get a write lock on the screen.
Transaction had to get a write lock on the person.
Yeah, you need to commit. All
right, so for practical purposes, then, if you want satisfactory behavior, the each transaction should commit before starting the next one. Matt, we lost the big display, and then it came back, and now everything is okay again. But it went blank. It was always okay here on the monitor. It was always okay here on the monitor, so I knew I could tell, and they could hear me. But I lost the big display in back, and now it's back. So. Okay. Thanks. Now, for practical purposes, if you can ignore brain transport as long as the user who sees the output doesn't do anything about it until the transaction that produced the output commits. So the user is sitting there at the display. You know, she sees the output of the transaction, but she refuses to act on it and waits until there's a message that says transaction committed, and then the output can be used and entered in for another transaction, because then we're sure that the other transaction comes later, right? Well, yes, if you're using two-phase locking, but in general, no, even that's not safe. All right. The reason why it's safe in this case is two-phase locking preserves transaction handshakes. So a transaction handshake is you wait for one transaction to finish before you start. You wait for one transaction to commit before you begin the next transaction. That's a transaction handshake. And preserving a transaction handshake means that in this equivalent serial execution, the transaction that finished first will appear before the transaction that started later in the handshake. And it might seem perfectly obvious that this is always going to happen. I mean, after all, you waited in between. But it isn't always true. It is true for two-phase locking. So what this says is, just read the slide, two-phase locking serializes transactions that are in a way that's consistent with all transaction handshakes. But it isn't always true. So let's see where it isn't always true. And as is often the case, the counterexamples are dead simple. So here I've got a transaction here, transaction one. And that's the whole transaction. It reads X in the beginning, and then at the end it writes Y. Okay. Now, in between, we've got two other transactions, transaction 2 and transaction 3. Okay. So transaction 2 writes X, which precedes transaction 1 precedes transaction 2. And transaction 3, this read operation on Y, transaction 3 precedes transaction 1. And that's it. Those are all the conflicts. So we have the serialization graph is that we have T1 has an arrow here to T2, which has another arrow, and then we have T3 before T1. So we got T3 before T1. So get rid of all this. So the execution is serializable. T3, T1, T2. Great. Now, I proved a theorem a couple slides ago that said all two-phase locked executions are serializable. What about the converse? Is it true that all executions that are serializable could have been produced by two-phase locking? And the answer is no, and this is an example of one. So let me argue for it to you that this could not have happened if I used two-phase locking. So transaction 1 starts out by reading X, so it sets its read lock on X. So far, so good. Now the next thing we want to have happen is to have transaction 2 write X. Because that's what happened. That's in the history. So it must have happened. The only way that can happen is if transaction 2 obtains its write lock on X. But clearly it cannot obtain its write lock on X because transaction 1 already has a read lock on X. In fact, so we have to release the read lock on X. But we want to obey two-phase locking. The only way we can do that is to first obtain the transaction 1's write lock on Y, which we know we're going to need later on. Now, this is not the automated locking protocol that I did from a couple slides ago. We're just trying to find some way of getting this to be two-phase locked. So we're going to get transaction 1's write lock at this point. That way, transaction 1 now has all of the locks that it's ever going to need, and it's no longer going to access X, so it's safe for transaction 1 to unlock X. Great. So now transaction 2 can lock X, which is what we were after, so that it can write X. And in fact, it can unlock X, and it can commit. So great. You know, we've gotten all the way to this point in the execution. Now it's time for transaction 3 to read Y. In order to read Y, it has to set a read lock on Y. But as we can see, transaction 1 has a write lock on Y, which we had to obtain very early in order to be able to get transaction 2 to execute. And moreover, it has to hold on to that write lock until after it executes W1 of Y, which is too late. So we're not going to be able to, there's no way we could have run transaction 3's read. This is getting too messy. There's no way that we could have run transaction 3's read at this point if we were using two-phase locking. Right? I just proved it. Because at this, the only way we could have gotten as far as the commit is to have obtained the write lock on Y early. And at this point, we can't obtain the transaction 3's read lock on Y, so we can't proceed. This execution could not have happened using two-phase locking. And it's a good thing because I just claimed that there was a theorem that said if the transaction is two-phase locked, it preserves transaction handshakes. And this execution doesn't. Because right here, we have a transaction handshake. Transaction 2 finished, it's done, and now transaction 3 started. So transaction 3 finished, then transaction 2 finished, and then transaction 3 started. But the only equivalent execution that serial has transaction 3 coming before transaction 2. Okay.
Question?
Yes.
Did you say that not all serializable executions are
Producible by
2PL, but all serial executions are always producible by 2PL.
Oh, I didn't say that, but it's true. So the question is, are all serial executions produced by two-phase? Could all serial executions be produced by two-phase locking? And the answer is yes. It's pretty trivial because it's serial, right? So each transaction can just march ahead and get all of its locks. There are no conflicts. And when it's all done, it releases them. And then the next one runs, and it does the same thing. So all serial executions could have been produced by two-phase locking. But not all serializable ones can be produced by two-phase locking. And in fact, as we showed here, they can even have different properties than two-phase locking, like not preserving transaction handshakes. And this is one that often, it's like another requirement. It's a hidden requirement that I talked about serializability, I talked about recoverability. But, you know, preserving handshakes is a pretty basic property. I mean, if you're building a programming model, I mean, you would expect people to think that when they ran that it would be okay to, you know, preserve handshakes. And in fact, the only way that you could fail to preserve a handshake is in an example like this one where the transactions have no conflicting operations. Transaction 2 is reading X. Transaction 2 is writing X. Transaction 3 is reading Y. They got nothing to do with each other. And yet, they're going to end up in the reverse order. And in fact, that has to be true, right? Because if they did have a conflicting pair of operations, you wouldn't be able to move them around. So, the reason why the requirement is important is all because of this brain transporter, this communications thing that I talked about on the previous slide. That's why this stuff is all tied together. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a requirement. Even stating the property never mind proving it. Proving it goes on for pages, but even stating the property is hard. For any two-phase locked execution history, H, there's an equivalent serial execution history, H sub S, such that for all pairs of transactions, TI and TK, if TI committed before TK started in the given history, H, then TI precedes TK in the serial history. You got to get those quantifiers in the right order, too. If you start those lines around in this statement, you're going to get into trouble. It's not just the fact that for every pair of transactions, there is a serial history that preserves the handshakes of that pair of transactions. It's much stronger than that. It says that there is one serial history that preserves all of the handshakes for all of the transactions in the given history. One last time. If a user reads the committed output of transaction I, then of course he or she should wait for transaction I to commit before starting transaction K, which is going to take that input. So you can rely on handshake preservation, transaction handshake preservation in this case. And people have even done work on user interfaces. You know, sort of the output of the transaction is starting to be displayed on the screen, but it's like blinking in red or something. You know, and if you read the manual, you find out that blinking in red means don't trust me until it goes solid white. You know, or maybe blinking yellow would have been what the right metaphor is here. But so even if the user is unaware of this rule, the fact that it's doing something funny will cause them to go into the help file or something and figure out, wait a minute, this has got to mean something. They're not just doing this. So, you know, because people don't read manuals, so you've got to do something to kind of get their attention that there's something here to be concerned about. Okay, let's talk about implementation. Why are we talking about implementation in this course at all? Well, you got to know what's going on under the hood. You know, even if you never implement a database system, you never implement a locking system, it's valuable to understand the implementation because at the very least it's going to have a big effect on performance, and also it's just pervasive. It's one of these base technologies that just comes up in so many other areas of computer systems that understanding how it's done in transaction processing, which is really the extreme case, carries over to lots of other areas where you might encounter it that are not related to databases or transaction processing. Yeah, question?
I was thinking about the previous thing.
Okay.
When is it that we care about, given that the this handshake thing, right? So we can have the transactions, the serial order be the opposite of what we expect. But given that these transactions don't have any conflicting operations, when is it that we care about the fact that in reality, if we don't use two-phase locking, there's...
Okay, so it's basically the question is, under what circumstances do we care about transaction handshakes?
Right.
And the answer is, whenever the output of one transaction is going to influence the input of the other.
Okay, but the output of, okay, for the output of a transaction to influence anything, another transaction has to read that output, right?
Well, somebody has to read it. Could be a person.
Okay, but the person is doing the handshake properly. The person is committing this transaction and starting the next transaction. What we're saying is that the data manager is not using two-phase locking. Right? So...
No, data managers are all using two-phase locking.
Let's say it's not. I mean, that was the problem.
Oh, okay.
If they were using that, this problem doesn't occur. Let's say it's not using it. But the user is waiting until the first transaction commits before starting the next one.
All right, so you want an example that's more meaningful than that little X and Y thing that... Mm-hmm. That I gave you a moment ago. I don't have one off the top of my head. I can try to whip one up, but I'm not sure I'm going to succeed. But it's a very reasonable request. Let's see. So,
I mean, if these things are
all right. So, I mean, this isn't going to quite do it, but it'll give you a feel for it. I'm going to pay my credit card bill to bring my balance down low enough in order to make an expensive purchase. Now, I happen to know that after making the purchase, the retailer is going to do a credit card verification against my credit card system, and ultimately they're going to come back and reject my purchase if I don't pay this bill because this expensive purchase will not clear. So even though the two transactions per se are not reading and writing shared data, I actually care that the one commits before the other one runs. Because if they end up effectively running in the other order, it's possible that as a consequence of making the retail purchase first, it will actually see my overly large credit card balance too soon.
Right, but then they're reading shared data. One of them is writing shared data when you pay your balance. The other one is reading it to see that.
So in time, you're right. That probably can't happen. That's why I'm not sure I can make this happen in real time.
Well, I was thinking in the XY case, even if another transaction could come in the middle and read both. I mean, does that?
Well, that's
anyway.
No, it's not a serializability problem. It's purely a handshake problem. But that's a good question. I should have a good answer for that. I don't. All right. So we know, roughly speaking, how a data manager is going to implement locking. It's going to be able to set locks, and as reads and writes show up, it's going to process them. And wherever there are locks, there are deadlocks, so it's going to have to do something about that. So let's see how this actually works. So this is how to build a relational database system in 3 slides. And anybody who knows anything about relational database systems knows how preposterous this is. Typically, hundreds of people working to build any one of these things. But so here's roughly how one is organized. It has the top layer is taking in operations, basically SQL operations, select from where on tables. That's how most transaction applications are programmed. And then the program itself has start, commit, and abort. So it says start, and it's got some SQL operations, and in between the SQL operations, it has some imperative language code. COBOL, C, C++, C#, Java, you name it. And then when it's all done executing, it either says commit or abort, depending on whether the result was okay. the database system only sees start, commit, abort, and the SQL operations. It doesn't see any of the imperative code in between. And those SQL operations pass through a whole bunch of layers. First, the SQL is parsed, and then it's optimized. That is to say, the order, if you look at this, the where clause, where it's got join clauses and selections and other things, it generally is not going to execute those operations in the order that they appear in the SQL statement. It's going to reorder them. In fact, it's even in some cases it has multiple algorithms. So for join, it probably has half a dozen algorithms that it can use to do the join. And the one that it chooses to use will be dependent on how the data is organized, how it's sorted, whether you're selecting on a very selective property like all the employees who work in the high-end jewelry department, or whether you're selecting on all employees who make more than $20,000 a year, which means you're getting a lot of employees, you know, back. So it depends on many, many things as to what the order of operations are. Finally, it picks one of these ordering of operations, and that order, that those operations are basically a flow graph of these operations, kind of a data flow program, and that goes into a layer called the query executor. These are high-level operations. You know, this is, you know, select all of the rows of this table that have a certain property, join them on some column with all the rows of some other table on a property, project out certain columns that we don't need anymore, et cetera, in, you know, high-level operators. Those operators, though, eventually do have to look at the data, and so each of those operators is reading records one after the next. So when it says, get me all the employees in the high-end jewelry department, it could be doing one of two things. One is it could actually be reading every employee record and for each one looking up the department number and seeing whether the person works in the right department. So it's saying, get first record, get next record, get next record, get next record, until it exhausts all the records. Or there may be an index. And the index would be just like the index of a book. It would map field values into the records. It would be, the index would have a list of all employees in the appliance department, all the employees in the toy department, all the employees in the high-end jewelry department. And so instead of reading all the records, it goes in, it opens up the index, it reads the index entry that says, here's a list of all the employees in the high-end jewelry department. Now that it has the list, it can go into the file of data and just pull out the relevant records, read them. But however it goes about doing this, in the end, it's going to read this fine-grained data. Either entries in an index or rows of a table or something else at that low level of the actual data. That's called the access methods. That's what the access methods do. Now, the access methods are accessing records. You know, read a record, get the next record, get the next record. That data has to be laid out somehow to go onto disk. And the disk is organized as pages, you know, fixed size blocks. So there's another layer that takes these pages of records and reads and writes them to disk and manages a big buffer pool. You know, so when you access a record, the system has to say, oh, well, you know, that record's not in my cache memory. I've got to go out to disk. Well, it has to figure out where on disk is the page that has that record. And I'll tell you how this is done later, but basically it can figure out from the record ID which page to get. It gets the page, brings it into memory, and then it can actually read the record and pass it up. So, you know, there's a lot of mechanism at every one of these layers going all the way down. So why am I telling you all this? Well, you know, up until now it's been read X, write X. You know, what the heck is X in this picture? You know, is it a join operation? Is that what it is? Is it a get at the index? Is it get a page? Is it get a record? Is it read a field of a record? What is it? And the answer is we got to decide. I mean, and you know, this is going to be part of why this is going to take hours to kind of go through and figure out how to get this to actually work in the real world, because this is reality. This is the kind of system in which we're going to be setting locks. Yes.
Are these records assumed to be fixed size?
Are the records assumed to be fixed size? No. Many years ago they were, because that was the best we knew how to do, but over time we've learned how to do better. So, I mean, I'm sure there are systems that All right, so the next page is basically just in words what I was waving my hands at in the figure. And the you know, the issue is which operations get synchronized. You know, in that history, what are the operations? Are they SQL operations? Are they read record, write record operations? Are they read page, write page operations? The answer is all of the above. It depends on what layer you're operating at. But the end effect has to be as if things were two-phase locked. And this is why it's so important to reason about histories, because that's all you've got to go on. I mean, you're going to be sprinkling lock operations all around a million lines of code. You know, you get this database system, it's a million lines of code in round numbers. And, you know, every now and then it's going to set a lock. And if you try to reason about the algorithms, about whether you set the locks in the right place, you're just never going to get there. I mean, you have to be able to reason in terms of the histories that are produced. I need to set a lock at this point because I know what the operations are in the history and I know what it means for that history to be two-phase locked. That's how you reason about it. Okay. So, that said, so we're going to come back to that in some detail over and over, but I just wanted to give you the big picture. Now, let's go back to the simple world where a fixed number of data items, I don't know, we're locking pages or something, just all very, you know, the complexity of the last three slides is now, we're going to factor that out for a while. How is it done? Well, the way most systems work, I would say the classical implementation, not the only way to do it, but the classical way to do it, is to build a lock manager. It's a separate body of code in which you set and release locks. It's got its own private memory, which is a lock table where all the locks are stored. And when you set or release a lock, you do it by reading and or writing information in that lock table. This is separate from the database. It's just a separate table of lock information. Now, this might not be what you had in your head. When I said lock X, you might have been thinking in terms of, well, there's a little, some bits in the beginning of the record X, which is where the lock is located, and before I read it, I got to set the bits in the record. And there are implementations to do that, but that's not the standard implementation. The standard one is you got the lock table off to the side as a separate data structure. Okay?
Is the lock table normally persisted on disk, or is it just kept in memory?
No. The question is whether the lock table is normally on disk. The answer is no, because why would you need it on disk? You know, if you, usually the answer is, well, either it's too big. Well, I mean, if the lock table is too big, the size of the lock to fit in memory, then the locks are the least of your problem. Right? Because where are you putting all the data? I mean, if you can't even fit the locks in main memory. So that can't be a problem. The other reason to put things on disk is because you want the system to be recoverable. You want to be able to recover transactions. But, you know, if the system fails and you lose the lock table, you've lost everything else anyway. I mean, you've lost main memory. You've lost the application state of the running transactions. So losing the, what good is the lock table? I mean, basically, if the system fails, all transactions that were active at the time of failure are dead. They're all going to get aborted. There's no reason, you don't need to know the locks. Okay, so that argument is not totally solid, because there are reasons, and there are systems, like Oracle, for example, actually puts its locks in with the data, which is an unusual, very unusual way to do it, but it works fine for them. So a lock manager services the operations lock and unlock. So the lock operation takes the transaction identifier, the identifier of the data to be locked, and the lock mode, like read or write, and it puts an entry in the lock table for that data item. So if the lock operation is to set a read lock on for transaction one, it puts an entry in here that transaction one has a read lock. And then it gets another request in to for a read lock for transaction two, And so it sets a read lock for transaction 2. And now finally, transaction 3 comes along and it asks to set a write lock on X, and it cannot, because in the lock table there are already 2 read locks on X and you cannot get a write lock. So you have a wait list attached and you add it to the wait list for X.
What if somebody comes in and wants another read lock?
What if somebody comes in here and wants another read lock? R4, or T4 wants... T4 wants a read lock. What do you do? Well, you know the story, right? I mean, you can either jump ahead, in which case T3 might be indefinitely postponed. A steady stream of readers will prevent transaction 3 from ever getting its write lock, even though there's never a deadlock. Or for fairness, you just line up T4 behind T3, which is usually what's done.
It looks like you'll have to lock the lock manager, otherwise you'd be modifying the table from 2 different places.
I'm sorry, what's
so the... So it looks like this is also an asset that you will have to lock somehow. So
yes. So it looks like this is a shared resource that you have to lock. No. You do have to make sure that the lock and unlock operations are atomic, because you know the model of the history is, you know, it's a sequence of reads, writes, read locks, and write locks, and you're expecting all those operations to be atomic, all or nothing. But it's not necessary to. It's not an infinite regress, and the reason is we remember how we proved phase locking is serializable. Right? We didn't need the reads and the writes. We didn't need the lock operations in order to do that. So this is okay. But that is a good way of thinking. That will get you far. There are going to be examples that come up later in the course where thinking about things at that level is going to be critical in order to do the right thing. That basically, things you forget to lock turn out to be important. Lock table is not one of them, but there are other things that you may forget to lock that are not so visible but are still very important. Okay, so we have an unlock operation or an unlock all operation to unlock all the data for the transaction. So the way this is usually done, the data item identifier is usually generated by a hash. You hash the data item into some fixed length, you know, like 32 bits typically. So it doesn't matter. So you can describe it. You can have the object that you're locking can have a very long name, but you just hash it into 32 bits. Of course, this is going to generate some spurious locks from time to time. Right? You're going to be locking things that are... two transactions update different objects, but they happen to be a hash conflict, and they don't know it. And so they're actually delaying one another. It doesn't hurt, but it's not a good thing. So you want a really good hash function. It spreads things out very randomly. The lock table is hashed on data item ID. So it doesn't have to actually have an entry for every piece of data in the database. It only has to have an entry for every piece of data that's currently locked. Because, you know, you've got, I don't know, billions, trillions of entries in the database, and you've only got a few thousand transactions accessed at any active at any given time. Each transaction is only accessing some modest number of data items, tens or hundreds of data items. So the number of locks that you're going to set is much, much smaller than the number of data items in the database. So you use the hash to limit that. Lock and unlock have to be atomic. I already said that. And they're called very frequently, these operations. They have to be very fast. So you can kind of work backwards. I don't actually know the current numbers. I haven't been following it. But it, just to, you know, if you want a transaction to run in a million instructions, probably you don't want locking to be very much of those million instructions. And transactions don't do that much. I mean, you know, they read your bank account, subtract $100, and write it back out. I mean, this should not be, you know, a very big computation. Besides the fact you don't want the transaction to hold locks for very long, because that's going to slow everybody else down. So you want it to run fast, get a lock, do its business, and release the lock and get out. So you want it to run quickly. So it's let's say it's a million instructions. So what's a we need to give a budget for the lock operations. What's a good budget? Like 1%? All we're doing is we're hashing a value into a table and storing it. I mean, you shouldn't take very many of those million instructions to be setting and releasing locks. So 10,000 instructions total for setting and releasing locks. Well, you might be setting, I don't know, tens or hundreds of locks. So you're going to have to get each lock operation down to like the 100, 200, 300 instruction level in order to be able to set and release them fast enough to get within the time bound that I just described. It has to be very fast. And it turns out this is hard to do. If you just sort of write this in normal code, it often comes out to be a lot more. And this is an area where people get right down to the machine code to figure out how to do it fast. When the first systems that were able to hit 1,000 transactions per second back in the 1980s, they were hard coding their lock and unlock operations in machine language. And really they were looking at instruction sets and instruction timings and clever ways of getting this done in order to, because they wanted basically the base case of setting a lock, they wanted it to be 10 instructions basically, because if you're going to get it to be, because sometimes you're going to have to go looking through the list and kind of searching and testing for conflicts. You're never going to do that in 100 instructions. So if you want the average to be 100, you better get a lot of them to run in 10 instructions or 20 instructions. And that's really hard. The only way you're going to do that is to really look at the instruction set very carefully. And remember, the lock and unlock operations have to be atomic. So that means you need some kind of compare and swap or something. You've got concurrent threads going at this lock table. And so they're going to have to synchronize, especially if it's a shared memory machine where you've got two or more processors that are actually going at the same database at the same time, which these days is, from now on, I guess, with multi-core, it's just the norm. So all that has to be worked into the code for managing the lock table. So it starts out as this really simple thing, set a lock, release a lock, becomes a profession. It's a job at least, if not a career. But it certainly is a job. Somebody is responsible for writing the lock manager. Probably only one person, maybe two. Maybe two to write it, but eventually just one person to maintain it, manage it. And it's not a big body of code, but everything that has to happen in that lock manager has, you're a walking incarnation of this very fast code that you've got to keep running very fast and very reliably, even though with every release of the software it has to do more than it did the last time. SQL is obviously the product. SQL Server is the product that I have access to actually get in some of these details. Some of this stuff can be found in product manuals if you want to dig. But in SQL Server, locks are approximately 32 bytes. Each lock contains a database ID, the object ID, like a record ID, and some other resource-specific information. It's attached to something called a lock resource block and a lock owner block. So, in other words, the lock table is a table. It's got two dimensions. The rows are the data items, which are called resources, and then in addition, for each transaction, you want to be able to get to all of the locks, because you want to be able to unlock. When a transaction commits, one of the operations is release all of its locks. So you need to be able to go through and get all of its locks one by one. So they all have to be threaded. So that means the locks at least have to be, to get down to the real nitty gritties, it's got to be doubly linked by a doubly linked list by resource ID, but only singly linked by transaction ID, because you can just add them to the end of the list, and at the end you're just going to run through and delete them all. But they're going to be deleted from the middle of these lists, so it has to be doubly linked by resource ID. It's a fairly complicated piece of code. We discovered in the project that it was complicated enough, time consuming enough, that it was better to give you one. It just took too much time. Not that it's an uninteresting piece of code to write. Occasionally a group will rewrite the lock manager, they just don't like it, and one of the project team just goes off and rewrites the lock manager, but most people live with the one we give you, just because it is a bunch of work to rewrite. All right, so I finessed that question of the size of a data item to lock. What are we locking? Records, pages, tables, what are we locking? Well, what's at stake? Well, if we lock big things like tables, then the locking overhead will be small because we will not have very many locks that have to be set. You know, you lock the whole table, one lock, that's it. Now you can access all the records in the table, you're covered. Not so good for anybody else who wants to use the table, but it at least reduces the number of locks. So coarse granularity of locks means you set very few locks, so there's little locking overhead, but because you're locking big chunks of data, there's going to be a lot of conflict, and hence you're going to get low concurrency. You're not going to get a lot of transactions running at the same time, because very likely they're going to start conflicting with other transactions. Fine granularity implies that there's many locks, because you're locking, you know, a transaction accesses all these records, every little record is going to get locked one by one. So that's going to be many more locks that have to be set, so there's more lock overhead, but you're only locking the data that's really being accessed. So the chances are that if another transaction tries to get a conflicting lock, it's not a phony conflict, it's a real conflict, because it's trying to get a piece of data that the other transaction is really accessing. It's not just that it locked too much. So fine granularity implies high locking overhead but better concurrency. So in the early days, mid-1970s, people went for coarse granularity locks. Page level locking was very common. IBM, which at the time had the biggest transaction processing systems by far, big mainframes, I don't know, they were a million instruction per second machines. They could run tens of transactions per second. These were all big numbers in those days. They observed that you had to do record level locking, the coarse grain locking was not good enough. So everybody else was running on mini computers and things, you know, they were only running four parallel transactions at most, because they had these little main memories and machines were small, so they couldn't get that much concurrency anyway. And so running coarse grain locks was fine. But the very first big relational systems built at IBM, already they had learned that they had to do record level locking. So from the earliest days, people were developing algorithms for that. But if you're running a big query that's going to read lots of data, fine grain locking is not going to be very good for locking overhead. You know, the lock table is going to fill up. Maybe you actually will overflow main memory if you know you access enough records. So what you want to do is have the transaction that's going to access a lot of records lock at a coarse granularity. If you're running a query and it's going to read all the rows in the employee table, it might as well just lock the employee table. But now what about the transaction that's going to come in and give Phil Bernstein a 50% salary increase? I mean, it's a low probability event, but it can happen. And it's the transaction goes in and it tries to read that record for Phil Bernstein in the employee table. And it locks the record, and that's okay, right? You know, it reads the record, you know, it knows it has a key or it has some descriptor for the record, so it goes in and it sets a lock in the lock table for that record, as opposed to the transaction that's locking the whole table, because it's setting a lock on the table. So you got one transaction with a lock on the table, another transaction with a lock on the record, and as far as the lock manager is concerned, they're two different locks. The lock manager has no idea that this lock on the record conflicts with this lock on the table. They're just two different rows in the lock table. You can say, well, now we're heading down an interesting road. You might say, well, maybe the lock manager should be a little smarter. Maybe it should know that that record is in that table. Yeah? We still got to set and release those locks in 100 instructions each. It could be a challenge. We're going to keep track of some elaborate hierarchy of which records in which page and which file. And so the trick is that the transaction that's going to set the lock on Phil Bernstein's record is also going to set a lock on the table. It's not a real lock. It's sort of just like just a little flag saying, hey, I'm about to set a lock on one of the records. Please don't lock the table. I'm not locking the table. I just want one record in the table, but I just want to make sure that nobody locks the table while I'm in there working on that record. You know, I'm working in this corner of the room. If anybody else wants to come in and use other parts of the room, that's fine. Just please don't lock the doors. You know, I need to get out. It's sort of like that. And so what you're doing is you're putting a little bit of extra work on behalf of the transaction that has to lock at a fine grain in order to allow the transaction, other transactions, to lock at a coarse grain. Yeah?
So the intention read lock is different from a read lock.
Yes.
Because with an intention read lock, somebody could go and get a write lock on a different row.
Yes.
Whereas they couldn't do that if it were an actual read lock.
Yes, so the observation is an intention read lock is different than a read lock because a transaction could get an intention read lock on the table and that does not prevent some other transaction from coming in and getting an intention write lock on the table and a write lock on one of the records in that table. So yeah, there's some very funny locking combinations that are possible here. I'm going to go through this in great detail. I just feel like it's necessary to explain it up front because it's just such a critical part of all of this that the whole solution is not credible unless you believe going in that there's going to be some way of dealing with this multi-granularity problem. Otherwise, I started out with this complicated database system. How can we do it? Now you can visualize it. You know, a SQL query comes in and the query optimizer looks at it and says, whoa, we're going to have to access the whole employee table. Gee, we better get a table level lock, right? The compiler, the optimizer, figures that out right away on the way in. And then all the operations that go down below, they're tagged. You know, when you access those records, don't waste your time setting locks on the records. We know we've already got a table lock. It's okay. As opposed to the SQL query that comes in to say, update the record with employee number 12345. And it looks at and the query optimizer looks at this and says, oh, well, gee, employee number, that's a unique key. There can only be one record with that employee number. We're only going to access one record. Well, we need to do a fine-grained lock on that record. We don't want to lock the whole table this time. And so it sends hints down to lower layers telling it, you know, just get an intention lock at the high level and lock the record. That'll be good enough. Because we're not going to lock, we're not going to access very many records. Okay.
So, if you have two levels of granularity, like tables and rows, it seems like adding in this layer of intention locks would roughly double the locking overhead.
Yeah, adding the intention locks is going to double the locking overhead for fine-grained lockers. So you're going to actually send, you're going to set a lot more locks than you think.
And yet that's still cheaper than...
And it's still cheaper than, yes.
And managing the hierarchy with
yep,
the set
lock. Yep. It's still cheaper than putting more logic into this. Is, well, I don't know. You know, engineering is a fun business. You know, you can never say what isn't going to work. You know, it's what doesn't work is just, you know, one smart person away from being able to work. That, you know, some clever person comes along and says, you know, there actually is a way to embed a lock hierarchy in the lock manager, and I can do it in a small number of instructions by some very clever exploitation of some number theory that, you know, nobody has ever thought of because I can do a funny encoding. So, but as far as I know, nobody does it. Okay, so, final, this is deadlocks. You knew this had to be coming eventually. So A set of transactions is deadlocked if every transaction in the set is blocked, and it will remain blocked unless the system does something to unblock them. So the simple classical example is transaction 1 sets a read lock on X, transaction 2 sets a read lock on Y, transaction 2 tries to set a write lock on X. Of course, it's blocked because it's waiting for transaction 1 to release its read lock. And now transaction 1 comes along and tries to set a write lock on Y, and it's waiting for transaction 2. So again, transaction 2 is waiting for transaction 1, so it's sitting there doing nothing. Transaction 1 is waiting for transaction 2 and doing nothing. They're each waiting for the other one. Nobody's making progress. This will go on until some outside agent intervenes. So deadlock is nature's way of avoiding non-serializable executions. See, you've all taken operating systems or written parallel programs, and you've been taught what a bad thing deadlocks are, right? Well, you need to learn to love deadlocks, because deadlocks are the way the system is going to automatically detect the fact that it's painted itself into a corner, and there's no way to complete the execution of these transactions unless it generates a non-serializable execution. That's what deadlocks do. Deadlocks are a control mechanism for preventing non-serializable executions, and that's great. Imagine how hard, if you have to, what's the alternative? Right? The alternative is to build a serialization graph in memory, and every time there's a conflict, add an edge and continually check for cycles in the serialization graph looking for non-serializable executions. This could take a while. Instead, all we're going to do is we're just going to set locks, you know, and if we ever get into a deadlock situation, it's up, non-serializable execution, we've got to do something. This is great. I mean, it's brilliant, really. Now, in order to repair, so let's say you've detected a deadlock. We'll talk about how in a minute. Let's say you've detected a deadlock. What are you going to do about it? So the obvious thing is, well, you know, some transaction has obtained a lock that's screwing up some other transaction, so let's release it. All right, so remember, we had transaction 2 was waiting for transaction 1. Now transaction 1 comes in and it's waiting for transaction 2, and well, there's no point in having it wait because that's just going to cause a deadlock. So instead, maybe what we should do is we should just back out this read lock on X and let transaction 2 finish, and then we'll come back and we'll get the read lock on X and finish running the transaction. Does that work? Can't possibly work. You just released a lock, and now later on you're going to obtain a lock. Right? That's the thing you're not allowed to do. You've broken two-phase locking. So if you end up in a deadlock situation, the only way out is to abort one of the transactions. Now, of course, you can rerun it from the beginning. That's fine. But what you can't do is just back out some of its locks, let some other transactions through, and then go back and get the locks again. That you cannot do, because that violates two-phase locking and therefore opens you up to the possibility of non-serializable executions. So to repair a deadlock, you've got to abort a transaction. And again, you know, sort of on the face of it, it seems like not a great idea. I mean, you're going to abort, I mean, this poor transaction, it didn't do anything wrong. It was just accessing data and, you know, some other transaction, you know, it's the other transaction's fault. I mean, it was doing fine. It was just this other transaction tried to access some of the data that it had already accessed, and so they're deadlocked. And why should it be penalized and have to abort? Well, you know, that's the price you pay. So one possible way out, which you've, again, probably read about, is deadlock prevention. Right? See, we're going to use one of those algorithms you've seen for preventing all deadlocks. And this is often advocated. Every operating system textbook, I think, you know, talks about ways to prevent deadlocks. But it's absolutely useless for transaction processing, because the only way to prevent a deadlock is to run transactions serially. That seems, really? I mean, there's nothing in between? Well, let's look at it. Transaction 1 sets a read lock on X. Transaction 2 sets a read lock on Y. At this point, our fate is sealed. That's all that's happened now. Each transaction has gotten a lock on different data. From now on, it's absolutely inevitable that these transactions are going to deadlock, because we know that transaction 2 is going to get stuck trying to get a lock on X, and transaction 1 is going to get stuck on getting a lock on Y. And it doesn't matter what order they run or what order they request their locks, they will deadlock. Right? So the bad event, apparently, was getting the read lock on Y. Once we got the read lock on Y, it was over. The deadlock was certain to happen. Well, I mean, so the only way to guarantee, we're talking about deadlock prevention now, not just, you know, avoid it in some situations. If you really want to prevent deadlocks in all situations, you're going to have to run transactions serially. So there is another possibility, which is if you can exploit resource ordering. This is something that's often advocated. If all transactions get there, so let's say we've got three pieces of data in the system, X, Y, and Z. And transactions are coded so that they always access X before they access Y and Z, and they always access Y before they access Z. So they're always going to get their locks in the order, first on X, then on Y, then on Z. That means that if a transaction is waiting for another transaction on any piece of data, the other transaction cannot be waiting for it. Why is that? Well, let's say you've got a transaction 2 that's waiting for transaction 1 on Y, because transaction 1 has already obtained a lock on Y. Well, transaction 1, all that's left is to get Z. And by definition, transaction 2 cannot have gone to access Z yet, because it already got stuck on Y. So it's essentially all transactions are kind of marching through the system in the order X, Y, Z. You know, and they're kind of getting in line and following that path. They can skip over data, but they can't. But they've got to follow that sequence. So that's another way to do it. And that will work, provided that you're in a part of the system where the access pattern is very predictable. So for those of you, I'll explain this much later in the course, but for those of you who know how B-trees work, there are special locking protocols for B-trees that exploit the fact that all transactions are going to search the B-tree from root to leaf. And if you don't know how B-trees work, don't worry about it. I will explain it and show you how that all works. But if you have a data structure, basically, where all transactions are going to march through in the same order, then you can exploit that order in order to avoid deadlocks and still get the benefits of two-phase locking. And in fact, you can even break two-phase locking as long as you march through in the right order. So what transactions actually do in systems is deadlock detection is used, not prevention in most cases. You detect deadlocks automatically. But we've been going for an hour, and I want to do another break, so let's stop now and take 5 minutes or so. And then when you come back, I'll wrap up this chapter. Okay, so the way most systems work, virtually all of them that I know of, they use deadlock detection, and they abort the deadlocked transaction, which is normally called the victim. And so you've got a couple of problems here. One is how to detect the deadlock, and then how to select the victim. One possible way of detecting deadlocks is timeout. If a transaction has been blocked for too long, whatever too long is, much longer than it was expected to take to run it, then abort it. I mean, this sounds so dumb that it's sort of hard to imagine it could be any good at all. And it's really surprising that it actually works pretty well. It's simple, it's easy to implement. It does abort unnecessarily, obviously, because a transaction could just be blocked and actually the locks that it's waiting for will be released and it will be allowed to run, but it just got impatient, if you will, and self-destructed a little too soon. And moreover, some deadlocks will persist for too long, because you know, if you're just using timeout, if you had been going in there and explicitly checking for deadlocks, you might have discovered the deadlock much sooner. Excuse me. So the standard solution is to use a graph that looks surprisingly similar to a serialization graph, called a weights for graph, where the nodes are transactions and the edges are weights for situations. So every time a transaction starts running, that transaction ID gets added to the weights for graph. If a transaction is waiting for another transaction, so you know, transaction one tries to set a write lock on X, it's unable to do so, the system the code that's calling the lock manager, which creates the blocking situation, adds an edge to the graph that says from transaction one to whichever transaction owns the lock that transaction one is waiting for. And the theorem is, if there's a deadlock, there's a waits for graph cycle, right? Because that's what a deadlock is. That transaction one is waiting for transaction two, which is waiting for transaction one. Or maybe it's a length three. One is waiting for two, is waiting for three, is waiting for one. So, and detecting cycles in a directed graph is cheap. There's linear time algorithms to do this. So, to find deadlocks, when a transaction blocks, you add an edge to the graph, and you periodically check for cycles. Now, if you want to be aggressive about it, every time you add an edge to the graph, you check for cycles. Because, after all, each edge you add could be the one that closes a cycle. But cycle detection is not free, and it's not that important to detect it instantly. One thing you can be sure is if you wait and you only detect a deadlock, you only go and detect deadlocks, detect cycles periodically, you don't have to worry about ever missing a deadlock. I mean, it's sort of a joke, isn't it? I mean, the one thing about a deadlock is that it'll whenever you get around to checking for cycles, it will be there. So it's only a question of how long you're delaying in checking for the cycle that is unnecessary, that these transactions are exhibiting poor response time because they're sitting there waiting for the deadlock to be detected, and you're just not investing effort to detect it often enough. All right, so you detect it with some kind of frequency, reasonably often, but not necessarily on every blocking situation. And when you detect a deadlock cycle, you select a victim and you abort it. And usually the rule of thumb is select a victim that hasn't done very much, because you haven't invested. This is a double win. First of all, you're not losing that much work. It's going to be relatively cheap to do the abort. And I suppose it's even good for the transaction, because this transaction hasn't gotten very far. Its response, it hasn't been delayed all that long anyway, because it hasn't done very much. So you might as well pick that one to abort. So now all you got to do is figure out which one is that transaction. There are various pathological situations where transactions can go in and get into a synchronous loop where they're aborting each other. So without looking even at the example, just imagine transaction one starts running, transaction two comes along, sets a couple locks, gets blocked on transaction one. Transaction 1 is not done. It deadlocks. It tries to lock something that transaction 2 has locked. It deadlocks. It aborts. Starts running again from the beginning. And it bumps into transaction 2. It's now a new transaction, transaction 3, but it actually is the same old transaction having started up again. And now they deadlock again. And now transaction 2 aborts, and it goes back. And you can actually end up, it's been shown, there are self-synchronizing cycles where they just keep on causing each other to deadlock. That's called cyclic restart. One way to avoid it is that you always choose the youngest transaction in the cycle as the victim. That way, whichever transaction is the oldest transaction in any cycle will never be aborted. So who's ever in front of the queue, who's ever got the high, effectively the oldest transaction always has priority. And then you can combine that with other heuristics. So for example, in SQL Server, what they do is they keep track of the amount of log space that's been consumed by each transaction. That's a measure of the amount of updates that the transaction has done, which is also a measure of how much work it's going to be to undo the transaction if it aborts. And they look for transactions that have not done very much updating. And, you know, sometimes that's a good thing to do. It might not be always a good heuristic. I mean, it could be you've got a read-only transaction that's reading tons of data, and you've actually invested a lot, but it hasn't written anything, so its log is virtually empty, but you end up choosing that as a victim. Maybe not such a good thing. Applications can influence this. So if a if you're running an application and you know that certain transactions deadlock often, and certain transactions you know it's okay either because you're never running them with someone sitting at a display device waiting, or for some other reason you know it's okay for that transaction to be aborted whenever it encounters a deadlock cycle, then you can explicitly say this transaction, when it runs, has a low priority or a high priority for deadlock, which means that if it has a low priority, that means, you know, kill me first. You know, if I'm in a deadlock cycle, this is the one that doesn't matter. So you basically want some small number of tuning knobs in this picture to be able to help in Yeah.
So the whole concept of picking an arbitrary victim isn't really sitting well with me, although I'm sure it's probably fine.
You don't like the idea of picking an arbitrary victim.
Right. So what I'm wondering is, in cases where the victim is just aborted, but they haven't really done anything wrong, like, do any data managers or any database systems try to sort of kind of reconstitute their state or rerun their transaction in a later time or do anything to try to sort of buffer the application from that arbitrary abort? Or is it just sort of assumed, well, the application can deal with it and we'll just have to...
So you're asking whether somewhere on the front end of the system you enter or run transactions in a way to kind of prevent these deadlocks from happening so often?
More like when a deadlock occurs, do any of the main database systems out there try to somehow, like, and they have to abort one of their arbitrary victims, can they try to buffer the application from actually, you know, the bad effects of that abort by somehow maybe like rerunning the transaction or...
Oh, yeah. Okay, so you're worried about the fact that there's some poor user, they've entered a request, their transaction has aborted, and they get this message back saying, deadlock abort. Huh? I'm trying to deposit $100 in my account. What are you talking about? Deadlock abort. Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of middleware in this picture, which I talked about briefly in the first lecture, but there's basically that is capturing the request to run the transaction, is actually running the transaction, and if on certain kinds of errors, like a deadlock abort, is actually holding on to the request and then rerunning it. There may be some persistent error. It could be that it tries to rerun it multiple times and the problem keeps happening. And at some point, it may actually give up and say, you know, please call help desk or something. Somebody might have entered incorrect input for which the application program was not robust. It was not doing enough error checking to recognize that the input was wrong. And when it finally got down into the runtime accessing the database, it kept doing something that caused it to abort. I mean, it's not a deadlock, but could, many reasons why a transaction could abort. So yeah, that's an. And in fact, there's a whole section. There's a whole chapter of the book, the textbook, chapter 4, which is all about how to do this. It solves some other problems too, but it's basically how to manage. This is request management. So you know, we're focusing now on transaction management. We're running transactions, but remember my very first slide in the course. I said, you know, there's the request to run the transaction. There's the program that is run by virtue of the request having been entered, and then there's the actual execution of the transaction. And the execution is what's really the transaction, when I use the word transaction. That's all we're talking about now is transactions. Your question is about requests. How do I manage requests? The request comes in, I try to run it, something goes wrong, what does the system do to insulate the end user from certain kinds of errors in the request processing that really in no way was the user's fault? Okay. This is good too. I mean, I'm not, you know, if you're bothered by these sorts of issues that are sort of loosely related, part of what's going on in this course is to give you a picture of the system. There's a lot of moving parts. You know, one minute we're down at the, you know, at the lowest level of detail, counting instructions to set and release locks. You know, in the next second we're worried about aborts, which are going to affect retries that the user, you know, many, many layers higher in the software stack is going to experience. And part of this is just to kind of eventually get this all in your head. That's why building a system, why the project is so helpful, because you end up eventually kind of seeing how all the pieces fit together, and you can kind of visualize the system as a single thing, which is where you want to get to. I mean, knowing the mechanisms is also important. We're focusing on that too. But in the end, it's understanding the whole system, which will probably be the most valuable thing you get out of this course, just all the, how all the pieces fit together. All right, so there's what if the data is distributed? I mean, I talked about detecting deadlocks by checking for cycles in a graph. That's great if the database is in one place and there's one lock manager and the transactions are all coming in there and all the delays are happening in that one spot. What if the transaction is accessing data in two locations? Where are you going to detect deadlocks? Well, you can detect local deadlocks in each location, but the deadlocks might span the locations. So, okay, so and yeah, it mentions two-phase commit here as a related issue for atomicity. So running a distributed transaction is not a very complicated thing, really. The transaction, it runs somewhere. It's got a program. It accesses local data. At some point, maybe it wants to access remote data. Either it issues a remote call to access the remote data, or maybe it just calls another program, and that other program accesses the data on the other node. Whatever it is, the program's kind of, think about it as kind of wandering around the system, and accessing data in these multiple locations. In the end, it's reading and writing data in two or more locations. When it commits, we have to run two-phase commit. We already saw that. We're going to go into that one in great detail. But there's this other issue that we have this deadlock, which now might be spread around. So what are we going to do about it? And just to see how a distributed deadlock can happen, suppose at one machine, you've got transaction 2 waiting for transaction 1, and on the other machine, transaction 1 is waiting for transaction 2. I mean, could this really happen? Well, why not? I mean, transaction 1 set a read lock on X, transaction 2, second step, sets a read lock on Y. Now transaction 1, which is still active, gets blocked over here. And now transaction 2 gets blocked over here. So perfectly fine. This absolutely could happen. what do you do about distributed deadlock? Well, we'll start back in the beginning. I said timeout is a possibility. In a distributed system, it actually makes a lot of sense because the alternative is going to be quite a lot of bookkeeping. So it's actually a pretty popular mechanism, that namely that you detect deadlocks by timeout. You have some, you know, most transactions are going to finish within a few seconds. You can pretty much count on the fact that these are transactions. These are not big application programs. They're supposed to run fast. So you can pretty much count on the fact that they're not going to run for more than, say, 10 seconds. If they run for more than 10 seconds, something's very wrong. And except for queries, maybe long-running queries, you're going to have to give some special timeout for them. But for most transactions, you take some default, 10 seconds, 20 seconds. That's good enough. And if they run for longer, you say, well, maybe it's a distributed deadlock, and you just abort it. And then you don't have to do anything about distributed, anything more complicated about distributed deadlocks. You might abort unnecessarily sometimes. You might wait too long to catch a deadlock, but the alternative is to do some pretty complicated distributed cycle detection in a graph that's spread around multiple nodes. Doable, but not easy. So this is how SQL Server works. It's also how Oracle works. Oracle, at least the last time I read the documentation, was selecting the transaction that closed the deadlock cycle is always the victim. You know, and it's another one of those heuristics. It's just really simple, and it quite possibly is good enough. I mean, apparently it is. Oracle scales like crazy. It's a big system. It's just a heuristic decision, and you know, it gets the job done without doing anything fancy about victim selection. A lot of these fancier algorithms, you know, it's just some engineer building the product decided that this was an interesting problem, and you know, just got disturbed by the fact that transactions were being deadlocked or aborted when they didn't have to be, and tried to come up with a fancier victim selection algorithm. They never really went through any performance analysis or, you know. Waiting, they had the time, they were assigned the project, they tried to do a really good job and engineer it, you know, in a very accurate way. When in fact, you know, simple and stupid would have been just as good in some of these cases. So we, you know, in some of these cases, we just don't know. We don't know whether we're over-engineering solutions or not until somebody comes along and does something, you know, simple and stupid and turns out to work really well. Until that point, everybody's under this blind belief that you have to do a fancier solution. And even in this deadlock area, we've been doing this for 30 years, I still think that there are unanswered questions in that regard. There was a question.
Yeah. So does that mean it's checking for deadlock at every lock attempt? Because if you do it periodically, how do you know which one closes?
I think it is. I think it might be. But I'm not remembering.
Yeah. I mean, that's expensive.
That's a different expense, but it's another decision, right? Maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's not. Maybe they're getting some. Maybe one compensates for the other.
We wouldn't tell them though. So.
You can do it.
You're not listening.
You can do it by looking at the lock table, right? Even if you're doing periodic, can't you tell from the lock table which came first?
No. Well, you can, but the question is whether you could figure out the deadlock by looking at the lock table. You absolutely could, but it would be a lot of running around the lock table. The reason for maintaining the graph separately is it's an abstraction of the waiting situations that is much more compact and more efficient to check for deadlocks than having to do it inside the lock table itself. Also, the lock table, remember, is being accessed at a very high rate, and so you don't want that to be a bottleneck. You don't want to, you know, while you're checking for deadlocks, you can't have its contents changing out from under you. It'd be very hard to get an accurate deadlock detector that way. There are fancier algorithms, many fancier algorithms. One is to have a server to do, you know, a central server for doing distributed deadlock detection. So what happens, it actually makes sense, and I think DB2 works this way. At least somebody from there was describing this to me, and I don't know whether they actually do it, but they've certainly thought about doing it, IBM. And that is, you have a central deadlock detector, and then every node in the system periodically sends its weights for graph to the centralized deadlock detector. And it periodically checks for cycles by taking the union of the graphs. Now, the thing is, you've got to be doing this often enough that you're going to be detecting deadlocks better than you would if you used timeout. But, you know, that's plausible, because if you're going to end up using something as big as a 10 or 20 second timeout, you probably can afford to check for cycles, even in a distributed case, more often than that, without creating too much overhead. These graphs are not that big. The cycle detection isn't that expensive. Maybe it's actually a net win. I don't know. But it's one possible way of doing it. One interesting question that arises here is, if you're asynchronously, each node is asynchronously sending its deadlock graph, its waits for graph, to the central server. So they're kind of out of sync. At any given time, the deadlock graph that you're looking at, the waits for graph, rather, that you're looking at, is not a perfect picture of what's going on in the system. Some of the edges may already have disappeared. There may be other edges that exist at the local node, but the central deadlock detector hasn't seen it yet. So the question is it possible that the centralized deadlock detector will detect a cycle that isn't really there? That it will say, just because it's out of sync, that it will see a cycle, and there really is no deadlock, and so it's just going to go off and abort a transaction for no good reason. And the answer is no, it's impossible. And the reason is that the deadlock graph, the waits for graph, is a subgraph of the serialization graph. Right? Every edge in the waits for graph will eventually be an edge in the serialization graph for the history that actually executes. Right? So if there were a waits for graph cycle, then there must also be a serialization graph cycle. And we know that there must really be a deadlock that's actually got to be detected. Because if it weren't a real deadlock, then that would mean that since every one of the edges in the cycle was going to eventually be in the serialization graph, if we had a waits, how shall I say this? If there were a waits for graph cycle, but it wasn't a real deadlock, that means that there's a serialization graph cycle. Because if it's not a real deadlock, that means all the transactions are going to finish. And if they all finish, that means every edge in that waits for graph cycle is going to turn into an edge, a conflict, in that order, in the serialization graph. And we know that can't happen, because two-phase locking doesn't allow non-serializable executions. So it actually, even without thinking about how the synchronization works, we can deduce the fact that a phantom deadlock is impossible. Kind of an interesting line of thought. Another technique, one of the properties of deadlock detection is it's cycle detection in a distributed directed graph. So if you've ever hung around graduate students, you know, trying to get advanced degrees, you know they're looking for well-formed problems with very simple problem statements and very complicated solutions. Right, because that's the way you write a thesis, master's thesis or PhD thesis. So therefore, there's a big literature on techniques for solving this deadlock problem. It doesn't mean it's an important problem. It just means that it's a well-formed problem, which at a particular point in time, nobody was sure whether it was important or not, and therefore, it was worth doing research to try to come up with better solutions until it was finally settled whether one approach was better than all the others. And even whether it was important. So one of the techniques, there's a bunch of papers on this, are these flooding techniques, path pushing, where you basically move waits for graph information around the network in the order in which edges appear in the cycle. So transaction one is waiting for transaction two. Well, let's send that edge to every node where transaction two might be running. All right, and we might know that because transaction 2 was here, and when it arrived here, we know where it came from. And when it left to go access other data, we know where it went. So we'll just send that edge and edges like it just to the nodes that might want to know about this edge from transaction 1 to transaction 2. So we can kind of push these edges out around the system. All right, so that's another technique. And there's several algorithms that have been published. At least one of them I know of is wrong. I mean, it just plain doesn't work. But then you get to write a paper about that. You know, that's good. You know, if somebody published a wrong algorithm, somebody else can write a paper that says explains how the wrong algorithm is wrong. It's research, funny business. All right, so two more slides. What's coming in part two? Well, we're putting concurrency control on the shelf for a few sessions because I want to cover recovery, and then we'll come back. And the reason why I want to do recovery is that you need it for the project, and I want you to have a really thorough understanding of recovery. And also, I think the recovery material is more important. The next layer of recovery material is more pressing to know than the next in detail than the next layer of concurrency control material, and I'm trying to get stuff out in an order where I can produce a sensible exam which covers the material I think is really worth studying and knowing for an exam. All right, so this is sort of it's very funny. I mean, you see, I'm jumping around the book in weird order. We just covered the first three sections of chapter 6, and we're about to stop, and we're going to go do chapter 7, and then we're going to come back and do 6, and then we'll do 8. So there's a bunch of other techniques that are listed here. I'm going to talk about locking performance in some detail. I'm going to say a few more words about it tonight before we stop. Just have one slide. We're going to talk more about multigranularity locking, getting into details there. We're going to talk about hotspot techniques. A hotspot is a piece of data that's being accessed at a very high rate by lots of different transactions. Very popular. And if it's popular, that means there's going to be a lot of lock conflicts. What are you going to do about that? Deadlock handling might not do it. You have to do some very special things if it's really that popular. You know, it's just going to be the bottleneck in the whole system. Everybody's going to line up waiting to get a lock on that piece of data. And that's not good. So you need special stuff for that. Another related problem is query update systems, where you're running you've got a mix of transactions. Some of them are running updates, and some of them are running long queries. And you know, the chances are that long queries are going to bump into updates. And how are you ever going to get anybody to finish? Because you know, the chances are any query that's running for a long time will eventually start conflicting with some updates, and you're going to end up with deadlocks. It just seems like an impossible situation where you're just not going to be able to get things to work well. Phantoms is the problem of handling insertions and deletions from data. And this one's a hard to explain in a couple of sentences. Trust me, it's a problem. That it's very devious. You would think insertions, they're just write operations, but it turns out they're not just write operations. They're a little different. And the synchronization required to get this to run correctly is subtle. And then finally, I mentioned B-trees earlier, and I will talk a bit about B-tree locking, since it's just so important in relational databases, the dominant way of handling indexes in large databases. But I do want to say a few words about locking performance, though, even though I'm not going to get into the details. This is highly oversimplified, but it's important to know because it's like a lot of things in transaction processing, it's counterintuitive. As soon as you hear about deadlocks and that we're going to run at high transaction rates, most people's assumption is, boy, this is going to be a mess. We're going to have lots of deadlocks. I mean, how could it be otherwise? Because they're all running randomly. They're accessing data in random orders. We've got popular data items that they're all trying to lock. Surely there are going to be a lot of deadlocks. There are not. I mean, there can be. You know, there are certain very regular patterns that can cause deadlocks, and you can get rid of those with some fairly crude techniques. But it turns out deadlocks are not the big performance problem with locking. The performance problem is blocking. In other words, you end up with transactions being slowed down by each other just because they're blocked waiting for locks long before you end up seeing a high abort rate due to too many deadlocks. And I mean, I don't know about you, this is certainly, most people do not expect this. You know, you expect that if you end up with a high conflict rate, surely there'll be a lot of deadlocks. And the answer, no, that's not actually what's observed. So what you have to do then is it's not a matter of, if deadlocks were the performance problem, then whenever you start deadlocking a lot, you back off on the transaction load. In other words, if you're running 100 transactions in parallel and you see too many deadlocks, then you would back off. You would say, all right, well, let's only run 80 transactions in parallel and see if the deadlock rate comes down and get it to the point where it's acceptable. So you could imagine how to do performance management if deadlocks were the problem. But if blocking is the problem, what do you do? Because it's just, you know, this sort of slow decay. And, you know, the performance just keeps getting worse. There's more blocking. It gets worse. There's more blocking. And the answer is that you've got to have some way of measuring the locking load so that you know when it's just too much and you've got to back off. You have to have fewer transactions running in parallel. And there are various heuristics on how to do this. There's even some mathematics behind it that you can actually calculate, prove that these heuristics actually are doing the right thing, which is surprising because the math is very complicated. But it ends up coming up with basically the same answer that all the empirical studies have done. And a good rule of thumb is that if you've got more than, say, 30% of the transactions blocked, waiting for locks, you're in trouble. And that things are going to get much worse very fast. It's really a fall off the cliff kind of thing. It's you know, that you know, you run more transactions and the throughput. So okay, here's my graph. Horizontal axes, number of parallel transactions. All right? Vertical axis, throughput in transactions measured by transactions per second. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to crank up the load. I'm going to have two running in parallel, three running in parallel. You know, and in the beginning, the more transactions you run in parallel, the more throughput you get. And eventually, as you would expect, it starts to plateau out, you know, because you add some more transactions and, gee, you know, the chances are they're not going to get through because they're going to be locking conflicts. So, you know, you're adding more load, but you're not actually getting more throughput. And you would expect this thing to plateau out. It's worse than that. Not only does it plateau out, it plummets at some point. And the most surprising thing of all is when it plummets, the deadlock rate is low. You know? Because you look at this thing and say, well, sure, it's going to plummet because, you know, you get enough people requesting locks, eventually the deadlocks are going to be, everybody's going to deadlock, no one's going to make any progress at all. That's not what's observed. It is true that throughput goes down, but it's not due to too many deadlocks. And I'm not going to tell you why. And save that for another lecture because it takes a while to explain and it's already pretty late. So we're going to switch topics on Monday. We're going to get into recovery. The assignment that I handed out today is due a week from today. I mean, the lectures are going at a higher speed, but it's not reasonable to request that your work somehow accelerate to keep pace. So I will not be going over the assignment on Monday. I'll be doing it next Thursday. Okay. All done. Thank you.